The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Cass Sunstein. Cass is currently the Robert Walmsley University Professor at Harvard. From 2009 to 2012, he was the administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. He is the founder and director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy at Harvard Law School. He is author of many articles and books, including Nudge with our friend Richard Thaler. His latest book is called Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. Cass Sunstein, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
So I saw a piece in the New York Times recently that said you wrote this book because of the reckless talk of impeachment in the early weeks of the Trump administration before he'd like really done anything. And I'm wondering if that's true. And after a year into this administration, do you still feel that way?
Actually, that's fake news.
Okay.
I wrote the book because I bought a house in Concord, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
That was used actually in the Revolution. And that inspired me to think about what was the connection between that fighting in Concord, in which people were killed and they put their life on the line for liberty, and what they mean by that, what was happening in our little country before it was a country. And that got me thinking about impeachment and its American origins. So that was the main motivation for the book. I noticed that people were talking at the same time that I was thinking about that,
mm-hmm.
about impeaching President Trump even before he had done a thing.
Right.
And that did made me think that, you know, I should probably step back a little bit and think 18th century rather than this Tuesday.
Right. And there was a quote in the book that I thought was, right up front, which is, quote, loathing a president is not sufficient grounds for impeaching him. And, you know, there's so much in the book about the history of this process and how difficult it is to understand. But the one thing that seems to be clear is that what the founders were trying to do was avoid at all costs a monarchy and to preserve the republic.
Completely right. So if you read the Declaration of Independence, it is like a set of articles of impeachment. And who knew? But that's not a coincidence, because impeachment was really going rampant in our little country before there was an exchange of bullets. And so the fact that the monarchy was under siege, not because we hated a particular king, though we did,
mm-hmm.
because we hated the idea of a king,
hmm.
That's kind of a clue about what makes our country exceptional.
Yeah, this quote came through, which was, the colonies came to despise both monarchy and despotism. They thought that the former often led to the latter. So, yeah, they hated a king, but the idea they felt was inherent, that once you have that sort of king figure, it is bound to go bad. And I think science actually backs that up.
Well, that is the thought, and I think it even runs deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
All men are created equal, so the idea that some are born into royalty, that rankled. And the fact that the Constitution forbids titles of nobility, that's kind of regarded as a historical quirk. I think almost as much as the impeachment clause, it's not a historical quirk. It's a window onto what our country's about. That, as Bob Dylan sang, sometimes even the President of the United States has to stand naked. And that signals, you know, we're all human, and no one's better or bigger than anybody else, even if they have more money or more power.
And you have some first-person relationship with this because you actually testified during the Clinton impeachment proceedings, correct?
I did, and at the time I knew something about the impeachment clause. I'd studied it a fair bit because of my job. I knew a lot less than I knew now, but in the Clinton impeachment, what was clear to me, and this turns out to have survived more kind of obsessive interaction with the history than I had then, what stood out was he hadn't really done anything impeachable. Mm-hmm. That if you perjure yourself about sexual relationship, or if you obstruct justice in connection with a sexual harassment suit, you've done something bad and, on plausible assumptions, criminal. But that's not what the impeachment clause was all about. As you said, it's about preventing a monarchy, and that means about preventing the abuse of presidential authority. And Clinton, you know, in connection with the Monica Lewinsky stuff, that he really didn't do, or if he did, not in the constitutional sense.
Hmm. And the term that's getting thrown around a lot now is the term that has preserved through all these years, which is high crimes and misdemeanors. I think people use that term and they don't necessarily know what the term means in the context of impeachment and the Constitution.
Yes. So what emerges from the history is that the term high crimes and misdemeanors, they weren't really mysterious at the time of the founding.
Mm-hmm.
They had been used in England, and the people in our young country knew that. They'd also been used in our own states as a concept for triggering impeachment. And what was meant by high crimes and misdemeanors in England, as well as in our young country, was terrible actions that involved misuse or abuse of the authority you have by virtue of being a public official. That's kind of a mouthful, but the word misdemeanor you should think of not as a misdemeanor in the current sense of, you know, not a felony but a crime.
Mm-hmm.
You should think of it as bad action. Misdemeanor, bad action. And that's really what they were focused on. Bad action in the distinctive sense of abuse of public authority. And so if a judge is, you know, on the take and using his judicial office in a way that reflects the fact that he's corrupt, that would be a high crime and misdemeanor. If a public official starts abusing people's liberty in a way that kind of recalls what England did, that's completely an impeachable offense. And they had in mind, you know, not the answer to every concrete question necessarily, but they had in mind a principle that had a degree of specificity, and that cuts like a knife, really, through the problems they had, and it does the same thing for the 19th and 20th and 21st century, too.
I found it really interesting, too, that you don't necessarily have to have committed a crime to be impeached, and you write here, some offenses that are not crimes are nonetheless impeachable. Punishing political enemies, trampling on liberty, deciding to take a year off, systematically lying to Congress and the American people, such actions actually could count as high misdemeanors. So are you sort of framing there that these are the things that one could get impeached for?
Completely. So going back to the time of the founding, James Madison, who, you know, probably the greatest authority on the meaning of the Constitution, said in the Virginia ratifying debates that the abuse of the pardon power would be an impeachable offense. He singled that out. And abuse of the pardon power needn't be a crime. If you say, I'm going to pardon every police officer who kills someone who has the wrong skin color, that's not itself a crime for the president to do that, but it's definitely impeachable. In Massachusetts, it was said that if you invade people's liberty in a way that clearly, for the Massachusetts commentator, recalled the king, that would be impeachable, and clearly that wouldn't be a crime necessarily. In fact, probably wouldn't be. It would just be an abuse of presidential authority. And one of the great thinkers of the time, a guy named Iredell, said, you know, if you procure a treaty by lying to the Senate, that's an impeachable offense. And that signals that the line between crime and impeachable offense is very, very bold. That is, there are a bunch of things that aren't crimes that are impeachable, and there are some things, in fact, plenty of things that are crimes that aren't impeachable, like jaywalking or shoplifting or slugging someone in the face. The president does that could be assault. sounds like assault to me,
yeah.
But it's not an impeachable offense.
Huh. All right. So in addition to high crimes and misdemeanors, the other thing that's thrown all around Twitter is this idea of the 25th Amendment. You know, and people like invoke the 25th Amendment. Tell us about the reality of how one uses the 25th Amendment.
Yeah, I had a little personal experience with this kind of improbably, because when I was in the Justice Department as a kind of kid lawyer, when Reagan was president, I was asked by my boss to become an expert in the 25th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, though I didn't say, what the heck is that? In fact, I said, I thought to myself something that had a four-letter word that wasn't heck. But I had to learn, and it turned out to be relevant when tragically, President Reagan was shot. Fortunately, he was able to continue, but 25th Amendment became relevant. So that's a clue about what it's for. It's for inability to perform the job, which means that the 25th Amendment is not for bad actions, which is what the impeachment clause is for. It's for bad conditions.
Mm.
So you can have a president who commits high crimes and misdemeanors who's completely able to do the job. He's just doing it in a way that involves abuse of authority. And you can have a president who has not committed an impeachable act, but who has some physical or cognitive impairment such that he's not able to do the job. And the 25th Amendment is for the latter.
And your boss was Ted Olson at the time, right?
Completely.
Wow.
You know, a great American, Ted Olson.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the history of impeachment, because the kind of amazing thing is that, like, it's rarely been used. And at the presidential level, do you say three times or two times?
Well, I think you put it exactly right. Two times presidents have been impeached.
Mm-hmm.
The Nixon one kind of belongs in the same category because he resigned before the vote, and
right.
he would have been impeached. Now, in a way, that seems tiny, but considering that the number of presidents is in the dozens and the low dozens, less than four,
yeah.
2/3, isn't as small as it seems
mm-hmm.
if you don't look at the denominator. So the denominator is small. The numerator is also small, but we have a percentage which isn't exactly trivial of the total.
So we're talking about Andrew Johnson but we're talking about Bill Clinton. And you mentioned with Clinton that decades after it happened, the impeachment seems like incomprehensible. Was that just a purely political move, or was it heightened by the time we were in?
It was purely political. So whatever you think of President Clinton, there was a view on the part of some of his political adversaries, we got to impeach the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that they really were looking around for grounds. And he handed them a gift, which was perjury and obstruction of justice, and stipulating what I think is very probably true, which he did do those things. And that's a gift for a political opponent, but under the Constitution, it's not an impeachable offense. I think it's very hard to argue that it is, and yet the House of Representatives went ahead anyhow. So that's inexplicable, except on political grounds.
Right. What about the more historical impeachment?
Well, the kind of middle one we'll give, which is Nixon, and that is kind of the honorable one.
Yep.
And the Nixon impeachment involves some things that are, you know, probably there, though you could argue, which is obstruction of justice in connection with an investigation of whether the president had invaded the rights of his political adversaries. And that's there. You could argue it, as I say, but that's pretty solid. And there was another ground that was, I think, so to speak, unimpeachably solid, which is the president's abuse of the apparatus of the federal government, Nixon, that is, to go after political enemies. That's the core of what's an impeachable offense. So that one, I think, we put a check mark next to. The Andrew Johnson impeachment belongs in the same category as Clinton's.
Really?
And is not a legitimate use of the impeachment authority, but the analysis is a little different. That was an impeachment of the president for firing his Secretary of War under a statute that prohibited the firing of the Secretary of War. The way to think of that is, suppose Congress said you can't fire your Secretary of Defense, unless there's good cause or unless the Senate says it's okay, and the president goes ahead anyhow. What makes that kind of closer to an impeachable offense is there we're talking about the use, at least, of presidential authority and the unlawful use of presidential authority. So now we're kind of getting somewhere. What makes that a hard case for impeachment is, as the Supreme Court has ruled, the president has the authority to fire his cabinet by kind of constitutional decree. The executive power is put in the president of the United States. So President Johnson had a really good argument. It turned out to be vindicated by the Supreme Court that he can fire his Secretary of War no matter what Congress says. And to impeach a president for doing something which he has the constitutional authority to do, and it doesn't involve invading liberty or punishing political enemies or trying to insulate himself from an investigation, it's hard to argue that's an impeachable offense.
Was that one also politically motivated?
Yeah, no question about that.
Huh.
Definitely. Yeah.
So what's kind of interesting with Johnson and Clinton, very clearly politically motivated, but Nixon, that felt like that was going to happen, and that doesn't feel like that one was politically motivated.
Yes, well, it did have some polarization in the sense that Nixon had a lot of haters who hated him for grounds unconnected with
right.
what turned out. But you're right that it had a bipartisan quality in the sense that a number of members of his party ended up saying, you know, he's our guy and he's our, you know, we agree with him on the political merits, but this is beyond the pale. And the fact that his own party deserted him, not all of them by any means, but enough of them, that gave a signal that the nation was unifying around the ground that he had to go. And when his successor, his Vice President Ford, became president, he said, our national nightmare is over, which was a beautiful kind of unifying thing to say,
mm-hmm.
because it signaled, you know, this is our national nightmare, not
right.
one or another party.
Right, right, right. So one of the things that's interesting about all of this is what also lies at the center of this is how you interpret the Constitution. And you mentioned that Thurgood Marshall thought that it was very clear that the meaning of the Constitution was not frozen in time, that it was a living document. Scalia, the sort of brilliant jurist, by contrast, thought that that idea was anathema, that he thought it was a fixed document. How could such brilliant people have such completely different views of what this thing is?
I think the way to think of it is that this is an honorable disagreement among people who are really smart and
mm-hmm.
who have different, what's the right way to think of it, legitimately different views about the appropriate role of the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
So on Justice Scalia's view, the kind of worst enemy of self-government is judicial discretion.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can fix the judicial mind on the historical understanding, we can keep that enemy at bay.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Scalia was my colleague at the University of Chicago, and I was lucky enough to know him well.
Mm-hmm.
And he, the rule of law for him was the lodestar. And he thought if we fix the judges in the historical understanding, we preserve the rule of law. And that's the only way we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Marshall thought, you know, we have a evolving tradition where the original understanding of the document is often inferior to the principle that the document reflects. So a nation comes to understand that segregating people on the basis of race or forbidding people to have certain jobs because they're female is inconsistent with the principle of equal protection of the laws, or the freedom of speech, which is a broad concept in the Constitution, we learn outruns the particular understanding of freedom of speech that they had back then. And on Marshall's view, to allow judges to take the Constitution as having a principle that evolves, sure, that increases the risk associated with judicial discretion, but it also gives birth to principles of freedom and equality that are serving our country well. And that's kind of the disagreement. On my view, Marshall wins that argument.
Mm.
But on impeachment, my hope is Marshall would say, for that one, you're right. And the reason is that to loosen ourselves from the, I think, amazing understanding that the founding generation have had of impeachment is to unleash a kind of political chaos on the land where people say, you know, we want to impeach the guy because we think he's committed a crime and misdemeanor, and, you know, who cares what that originally meant. And others would say, well, it isn't a crime, so he's not impeachable. And then we have a kind of unmoored battle. We have nice mooring, and we don't really lose anything, I think, if we stand by what the people who fought the American Revolution understood their document to mean.
Yeah, that seems right. There's a in this section, there was two different quotes that really stuck with me. One was from Thomas Jefferson. You write that you quote him, laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, new truths disclosed, and manners and opinions change with the circumstances, institutions must advance also and keep pace with the times. The dead have no rights.
Beautiful, isn't it?
It is really beautiful.
And that's Jefferson, you know, not as a kid. This is toward the end of his life. And basically saying, you know, I admired that generation. I'm of that generation. But let us not weakly believe that one generation is not as capable as another of taking care of itself.
Yeah. The other quote was Justice Kennedy in 2015, and this was on same-sex marriage, where he said, quote, "The nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own times."
Completely. That's Kennedy siding now with Marshall against Scalia about how to think of the Constitution. And his view is that the Constitution is best understood to allow each generation to have a broader or better understanding of liberty and equality, and that, you know, that is reflected in the fact that we now have pretty broad freedom of speech. And the truth is that in the founding generation they made progress, but they weren't where we are.
I've around the office lately with regard to our conversations, both at work, also with what's going on in culture and in politics. I keep saying to colleagues, like, the phrase both things can be true, I'm finding myself say a lot. And I think that's kind of what you're saying here, because you're not coming down with saying Scalia's wrong, Marshall's right. But you're drawing that they both have opinions that matter and might be applied to different areas of the Constitution. In particular, in impeachment, you're kind of going the Scalia route, right?
Completely.
Yeah.
The reason, I think, is that to choose a theory of interpretation in the end, there has to be a judgment about what makes our democratic system better rather than worse. And I know Justice Marshall would agree with that. And I think in the end, Justice Scalia would have to. And then they'd be arguing about, for most of the Constitution, whose approach does that. At least they have a common criterion. For the impeachment clause, Scalia's approach, I think, wins on that criterion. And as I say, I hope my old boss, Justice Marshall, would agree.
All right. So like a very good teacher, you do not tell us what to think inside this book. You present a lot of information. I appreciate how careful you were in presenting it. But there is a section where you talk about what's impeachable. And when I started to go through this, I wrote down some ones, and I kind of want to talk about them with you. One of them was revealing classified information to a foreign power that wishes to do harm to the United States. That is impeachable?
Absolutely. It might be treason. It depends on exactly what the nation is. But if you reveal it with the aim of betraying your own country, that's clearly impeachable. If you do it in a way that's, you know, in good faith and negligent, then it would be much harder to say it's impeachable. But what I'm thinking is there's disloyalty involved, and that's what the high crime and misdemeanor idea is kind of fundamentally about.
Well, that's an important nuance. So if you sort of in ignorance hand over this information, maybe not impeachable, with malice, impeachable.
Sure. So, you know, General Petraeus was charged with handing classified material to a writer who was also his romantic partner, and that's not good. But I think to describe that as an impeachable offense if the president did something, let's say, vaguely analogous, would be hard. But if the president betrays his own country, and is, you know, concerned with the well-being of, let's say, unfriendly country as opposed to his, then it's impeachable.
Okay. Here's another one. Accepting a bribe in connection with his exercise of presidential authority.
Well, that's called out specifically in the document. So treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. So bribery in connection with your authority, there we are. That's within the text of the Constitution.
And that's either way, right? You can't try to bribe someone and you can't be bribed.
Completely.
Huh. Okay. Going after political rivals. Like you say, murder, beat up, use the IRS.
That would be within the kind of core of the idea of self-government, which is what the revolution was fought for. And, you know, I'm kind of privileged to live in a house which was part of the set of houses, one of the set of houses that the British came to on the day that the Revolutionary War started. So this is kind of literally home for me. And if you go after political enemies, use your presidential authority to do that, that's I think, the not quite English word is verboten.
So are just those four feel like we're skirting around that in our present situation a little bit? And I don't want to put you on the spot, and you don't have to be put on the spot because you don't have to answer me, but it feels like all those are things that are in the conversation right now with the actions of our current president. And I'm not saying it that, like, I don't think we know, but it does feel like it's of the conversation.
Well, you know, I think I worked for President Obama, and that was anyone who gets to work in the White House is very lucky. And I think that it is the gracious course to be very careful before saying something, you know, very dramatic about one's successor.
Yeah.
And so I think it's probably better for other people to say both very positive and very negative things about the successor of the person for whom you worked. I do think that, of course, if any president, Democratic or Republican, obtains the presidency by coordinating with an unfriendly country, the history is pretty clear that's an impeachable act. And as far as I'm aware, there's no evidence that President Trump did anything of that kind, but there are concerns that maybe he did. And whether we're talking about, you know, a Democratic or Republican person, you can't coordinate with an unfriendly country to obtain the office. That's not acceptable. That's impeachable.
Got it. Okay, and part of what is also good for people is to understand that we have a government that all has a role in this. And when you talk about the House and the Senate and their job in this particular situation, and I'm going to very clumsily tie in some of your nudge work on this, because it felt like the House was System 1 and that the Senate was System 2.
That's great.
Am I right on that a little bit?
Yes, definitely. So System 1, as the behavioral people say, is the part of the mind that's very reactive and intuitive and sometimes emotional and fast. And System 2 is the more deliberative and reflective part. I explained this to my 8-year-old boy, as any father would. And he said to me a few weeks after the explanation, he said, "Daddy, do I even have a System 2?" I wasn't quick enough to say, you know, boy, the fact that you asked that question shows that you do.
Yeah, right.
But you're quite right that the original understanding, at least, was that the House would be the more populist body, very reactive to what the public wanted, and the Senate would be have a cooling function. And both the lawmaking process and the impeachment /conviction process reflects that hope.
So what's interesting to me from my vantage point on all this is because this last couple of years in working with Richard Thaler's Center for the Decision Research at Chicago Booth, your partner and co-author and friend and recipient of the Nobel Prize. Thinking about behavioral economics, which revolutionized this thinking, which is basically in sort of brief terms that people behave irrationally. And so when we can think about that, perhaps we can, design or nudge situations more effectively. In our work in improvisation, very similar thing. So this was developed at the University of Chicago in the mid to late 50s. And improvisation is all about these exercises, rules, games that you learn that allow you to work better in groups. And literally, like, you can't say no, you have to say yes and. And you have to put all your focus on another person. All of these things are basically nudges to get you to sort of behave better. And it seems like the framers of the Constitution had a similar brilliance in mind. And this quote, I think, says it all, which is a combination of extreme partisanship, rapid spread of false information, especially online, and various behavioral biases will result in unjustified, harmful, and destabilizing efforts to impeach the president. So, I mean, you're kind of tying that they understood maybe sort of some of this behavioral science before it was invented.
There's so much in what you said. So, add a little bit, some supplements and some qualifications.
Yeah.
Both Thaler and I are very cautious about using the word irrational, on the ground that it's not quite right, I think, to think of people as irrational.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to think of them as boundedly rational,
right,
or imperfectly rational. So if you get all scared when your airplane is starting to shake because, your system one is going haywire, that's not irrational, but it's not fully rational because planes hardly ever crash, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
If you kind of fall in love because you see someone who's amazing and you think, I'm going to, date or marry that person when you don't know her, let's say, that it may not be irrational.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be exactly right. So your system too might think, I should probably get to know her a little bit first. So the way to think of it is kind of boundedly rational,
yeah,
and with systematic departures from rationality. I think that's one of the reasons Thaler got the Nobel. On nudges, the basic idea is that our system one may think, here's the route by which to get from here to there. I know it, or I have a kind of hunch. My stomach tells me this is the route. And that may be correct, but a GPS is a great nudge. It will tell you, here's how you actually get there.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have a better route because it's more scenic or some reason, but the GPS is going to put a system to check. And if you have a calorie count at a restaurant that'll tell you at McDonald's, the Big Mac is going to have this many calories, and the Trump administration just supported that Obama administration nudge. Good for them.
Yeah.
That is a system to help to your food choices. And if you are given information on your credit card bill, I just got one today that said, if you don't pay, here's how much you're going to end up paying after a period of time. And it's kind of scary. It said, after 3 years, you're going to spend, and it's in the thousands if you just keep paying the minimum. So that's good to know. That's
mm-hmm.
to check. So nudges of that kind can really help us to make better decisions. I think the framers were, they didn't know what Dick Thaler knows about human behavior, but they did know that passions can get System 1 really red, and that can lead a nation in bad directions.
Hmm.
So they didn't want democracy, as they called it. They wanted instead republicanism, and they saw republicanism as a system in which we the people would ultimately have control, but in which you had elections in which you granted authority to people who you choose, whose job it would be to kind of figure things out. And you can get rid of them if they're not figuring things out right. But System 2 is playing a big role, ideally. And so when you're figuring out, what to do about some issue, whether it's opioids or highway safety or air pollution in Chicago or Los Angeles, you're doing a little delegating to them.
There is a quote in this, and I think it sums it up well, which is, we the people can oust a president if we insist, but we have to run the gauntlet. And then that's what's going on. This is a gauntlet. I think people are so, again, this is the passion, right? And the confirmation bias, and what happens when we sort of move in our tribes is that we're quick to make these sort of indictments, and that doesn't serve that doesn't serve the Republic idea here at all.
Completely. And I saw this when I was in the White House, that things were said about what we were doing. And I continue to see this, by the way, and, you know, put to one side my own, of course, bias. Yeah. Just on factual matters, it's wildly crazy. And one of my coworkers said to me, basically 6 months in, he was a great critic of President Bush, he looked at me and he said with kind of amusement, I'm now thinking that three quarters of the things I hate most about President Bush aren't true.
Yeah. The arc of history. All right. So the way we finish this podcast with all our guests is we ask them for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, the way you can derail that is by saying no. And you can't just say yes, but you have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and moment from your work or your life that you can share with us.
Very recently, I begged my wife to let me take her and my boy to the Star Wars movie,
mm-hmm.
and she wasn't that excited about that. She's a wonderful person, with this exception, and I said, yes, and I will do anything over the weekend that's necessary for the household, just so long as we go to the movie.
Ah, and that worked?
Kinda. We'll see. Maybe tomorrow. We're going to try.
All right. Well, it's getting great reviews. Cass Sunstein, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.